From national news in D.C.
to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol,
this is your Capitol Connection.
And now, bringing the Capitol to you,
here's your host, Nate Graz.
Welcome to Capitol Connection. We are broadcasting today from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln, just blocks away from our state capitol, where we are working every day to advance family, freedom, and life, and to keep you informed on the biggest news in government, policy, and culture from a biblical perspective. On today's show, find out why Nebraska has been officially blacklisted by San Francisco, what this year's March for Life theme will be, what one of your U.S. senators had to say about presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke's call to strip tax-exempt status from churches, and finally, we'll talk about the tragic story of a 7-year-old boy whose future hangs in the balance as a court decides whether or not his mother can forcibly transition him into a girl against the father's wishes. So, as usual, we've got plenty to talk about, but I have to start the show today with this. Last week, it was announced that the city of San Francisco will no longer contract with any businesses in Nebraska, and they are prohibiting official government travel to Nebraska because of our pro-life laws protecting the lives of unborn children. That's right. City officials in San Francisco announced they are prohibiting official travel and business ties with Nebraska over our pro-life laws. According to the Lincoln Journal-Star, San Francisco Democrat Mayor London Breed and City Supervisor Valley Brown announced the city will implement a travel and contract ban for states with restrictive abortion laws, defined as laws that ban abortion before a fetus is viable to live outside the womb. And here in Nebraska, where abortion is prohibited after 20 weeks, we fall under that category. And in addition to Nebraska, the other states that have been blacklisted by San Francisco are Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Nevada, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. So if you're keeping track, that's 22 states in total, including Nebraska, that have been blacklisted by the city of San Francisco. So that's nearly half the country that they've put under this travel and contract ban. So to be clear, what this means is that official city business and official city travel is prohibited in Nebraska. This doesn't prevent the citizens of San Francisco from traveling to these states or doing business in these states. But if you are an employee of the city of San Francisco, you cannot conduct official business with these states or official travel to these states, which is just absolutely appalling that they would do this, that they think that they can be so authoritarian and try and shame these states, which they think are just so awful. These 22 states, including Nebraska, you know, Nebraska Nice, The Good Life, so terrible are our laws protecting unborn children that they can't allow city travel or business to our state. And so we wrote an article at Nebraska Family Alliance talking about this, and it got a lot of traction and a lot of reactions and positive comments. I think people were as shocked and appalled as we were to hear about this. And our message is simple. If coastal elites in San Francisco are going to create a blacklist of states that they won't travel to or do business with because of state laws protecting unborn children, then frankly, I'm glad that Nebraska is on that list. Nebraska has a strong history as a pro-life state. In fact, in 2010, Nebraska became the first state in the entire country to prohibit abortions after 20 weeks. And our nonpartisan unicameral, by the way, they approved that law on a 44-5 vote. And now states all across the country have followed our lead in adding that protection for children inside the womb. But Nebraska has led the way, and rightfully so. But now the idea that in Nebraska we don't allow unborn children who can feel pain to be torn apart in the womb. It's apparently so abhorrent to city officials in San Francisco that they can't allow their city to conduct official travel or business within our state. But thankfully, elected officials in Nebraska, you know what? They are not going to sacrifice protecting innocent lives over the possibility of Nebraska losing a few future business deals with the city of San Francisco. Which, by the way, you would think that city officials in San Francisco would be a little bit more preoccupied with problems like homelessness and poverty in their own city instead of worrying about what Nebraska and other states are doing on abortion. But Governor Ricketts responded to this announcement by saying, quote, "Nebraska is a proudly pro-life state, and this demonstrates shocking intolerance by coastal elites that is divisive to our nation." And in a statement released by Senator Ben Sasse's office, Senator Sasse said, quote, "Progressive cancer culture is dumb. Most Nebraskans, like a whole bunch of Californians, are pro-life and want to reflect our pro-science, pro-woman, pro-baby beliefs with common sense laws. Folks in San Francisco are free to disagree, but it's childish to try to shut down a big culture debate. Pro-lifers aren't out to silence the other side. We believe in persuasion. San Francisco progressive can throw a tantrum. Nebraskans will continue to act like grown-ups." So as you can see, this announcement from the city of San Francisco didn't exactly intimidate or send shivers down the spines of some of our elected leaders. And that's because standing up for precious, innocent life is always the right thing to do. And we refuse to compromise our state's values. And if that's too much for a few intolerant city officials in San Francisco to handle, then I think our new tourism slogan says it pretty well. Nebraska, honestly, it's not for everyone. And apparently that includes the city of San Francisco. You know, one of the things that Senator Sasse said in his statement that I really appreciated is that being pro-life is both pro-science and pro-woman. And this past week, the March for Life, the national annual march, the pro-life march that takes place in cities all across the country and where hundreds of thousands of pro-life people gather in our nation's capital, this past week, they announced what their theme will be for 2020. And the theme is Life Empowers. Pro-life is pro-woman. Pro-life is pro-woman. For the 2020 March for Life, the organizers have decided to honor the suffragist movement and celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. And this theme, pro-life is pro-woman, is so important because it's an attempt to change the messaging that often permeates our culture that being pro-life is somehow anti-woman, which is a lie. For years, Planned Parenthood and other abortion activists have rather successfully been able to frame the debate and their cause as one that supports equality and female empowerment by claiming that abortion remains a critical component of women's health care. And this notion is based on the false premise that the procedure itself is somehow a benefit and empowering to women. But we don't believe that that is the case. But unfortunately, abortion businesses and pro-abortion politicians have been able to successfully manipulate the public into believing that the consequences and results of abortion are non-existent and that abortion is healthcare. And the March for Life is attempting to change that narrative by recognizing that not only is abortion damaging to women's health care, but that throughout the world, it's female babies who are often the target of sex-selective abortions. In certain areas of the world, tragically, sex-selective abortions are common, especially in countries where boys are the preferred child for cultural reasons. In fact, one study estimated in 1990 that 100 million girls are missing from the form of our global population as a consequence of neglect, infanticide, and inequalities of care. And by 2011, another researcher estimates that that imbalance has reached 160 million. How is that for equality? when baby girls are being aborted simply for being female. Equality begins in the womb, and that's why this year's March for Life theme is so important, because being pro-life is being pro-woman. March for Life President Jan Mancini said that the upcoming march and its theme will seek to evoke confidence rather than fear about unplanned pregnancy and motherhood, and advocate for community support for unexpected pregnancies. And interestingly, Seren Foster, who is president of Feminists for Life, noted that this year's theme and the celebration of the 19th Amendment coincides with the original suffragists who were pro-life. She said, quote, "The same woman who fought for the right of slaves to be free and the right of women to vote also fought for our children to be here and for mothers to be supported." She went on to say that abortion is a reflection that we have not met the needs of women, and that abortion betrays the basic feminist principles of the early feminist movement, which were to advocate for non-discrimination, non-violence, and justice for all. And last year, for the first time in history, a sitting U.S. president addressed the March for Life crowd, and Vice President Pence also spoke. It's an important event to be a part of, and it will be taking place again in 2020 on January 24th. It's a great way to show the growing support for the pro-life movement for both women and their babies, and that being pro-life is being pro-woman. If you listened to last week's program, we talked at length about the outrageous and unconstitutional assault on religious freedom and the Christian church itself and religious charities when former Congressman and presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke went on national television for a CNN town hall, and he called for churches and charities who don't support same-sex marriage to be stripped of their tax-exempt status. Well, that didn't sit well with a lot of people, including one of our own United States Senators, Ben Sasse, who this past week took to the Senate floor to not only condemn this idea, but to formally introduce legislation condemning Beto O'Rourke's assault on the First Amendment and asking Congress to really reaffirm their commitment to the Constitution and not use government to decide which religious views are permissible and which aren't. It's a resolution asking the Senate and the House to reaffirm their commitment to the First Amendment and the freedoms that it preserves. And so I'm going to play Senator Sasse's remarks, because this is really important. People need to know what their representatives are saying. And what we're talking about and what you'll hear Senator Sasse talk about are the most basic, fundamental freedoms that come from God, not government, and are essential to any free and thriving society. But all too often, we take those freedoms for granted. And we need to know how to respond when people with influence and political power are attempting to target people of faith and undermine religious freedom. So here is what U.S. Senator Ben Sasse had to say last week on the floor of the United States Senate.
Mr. President, I come to the floor today to ask each and every member of Congress to answer this simple question. Is it right for the United States federal government to get into the business of policing Muslims, Jews, and Christians' religious beliefs about whether or not they are acceptable? Is it the business of the federal government of the United States to determine true and false religion? Last week, a former member of Congress didn't blink an eye, a former member of Congress now running for president, didn't blink an eye when he announced that he would strip religious institutions, colleges, churches, and other not-for-profit service organizations, he would strip them of their tax-exempt status if they don't agree with his political positions. That's a pretty major departure from what America is and what we usually talk about in this body. So we should pause and we should call that what it is. That is extreme intolerance. It is extreme bigotry, and it's profoundly un-American. The whole point of America is the First Amendment, and the whole point of the First Amendment is that no matter who you love and no matter how you worship, We believe in America that everyone is created with dignity. This is a fundamental American tenet. It's why this country was founded. And because we're all created with dignity, none of us have the right to dictate the conscience commitments of other people. The freedom of the conscience is a fundamental American belief, and thankfully, politicians have no business policing that. At the end of the day, there are really just two kinds of societies. There are societies that are about force and power, and there are societies that are about persuasion, about assembly, and about love. And for more than 230 years, we've decided in this country that we're the latter. We are a community of persuasion, not primarily a community of power and force. In America, we don't think the center of life is defined by government. We think the frame of life is defined by government. Abraham Lincoln, often sort of apocryphally summarizing George Washington, used to talk about the silver frame and the golden apple. In America, the government is just the silver frame. It's the structure that defines the framework for ordered liberty so that the golden apple, the good, the true, and the beautiful, the things that you love and that you want to build, you go do by persuading people to join with you in a cause. Government doesn't define the center. Washington, D.C. is not the center of American life. Washington, D.C. is supposed to be a servant community that exists to maintain a framework for ordered liberty, guards us against enemies foreign and domestic, so that your household and your neighborhood and your place of worship can be the center of life. We are not Chinese communists who take Uyghurs and throw them into camps. We are not Russian oligarchs who tell journalists what they can and can't write. We are not Venezuelan strongmen who beat the hell out of protesters. We're Americans. And in America, we disagree about many things. We disagree profoundly and vigorously, but then we come together and we create a system where we work out our differences not with fists, but with words. We work out our differences with civility and tolerance and respect and persuasion. All of this starts with the First Amendment. The five freedoms of the First Amendment, religion, speech, press, assembly, and protest, define who we are as a people and what we believe in common. And guess what? You can't separate these five. These five freedoms are all in the same amendment for a reason, because if one of them falls, they all fall. They stand or fall together. And you're a hypocrite if you pat yourself on the back for defending one of these five freedoms, and then the next day when another one is unpopular, saying, well, we don't need that one, we can throw it overboard. The five freedoms are interconnected, they're interdependent, and they're all in that same amendment, the First Amendment, for a reason. These are the rights of conscience that belong together and that cannot be taken or policed by government. So that means that if a Texas politician pandering for a soundbite decides to make a bold-faced threat against Muslims and Jews and Christians, all Americans from every faith and every walk of life, we have an obligation to come together and to defend our freedoms. And so we should do that. That's what I'm here on the floor today to do. I'm introducing a simple resolution today that will give every member of the Congress, the House and the Senate, the opportunity to tell our constituents whether or not we still believe in the First Amendment. It's an opportunity to show the American people that bigotry against religion in the name of partisan politics is not permitted in our system of government. This isn't a Republican or a Democratic premise. This is an American idea that we condemn politicians who say they're going to police other people's religious beliefs. Congress doesn't target or punish organizations that are exercising constitutionally protected rights. This really shouldn't be complicated. Government doesn't rifle through your pastor or your rabbi's sermon notes. Government doesn't tell your clerics what they can or can't say. Government doesn't tell your religious leaders how they will perform their services. Government doesn't tell you where or when you will worship. Government doesn't teach our kids how they're to pray. And government doesn't lecture you on heaven and hell. Government's job is not to define true and false religion. That's something much closer to the center of the frame, the golden apple. The silver frame is the humble job we have to do in public life, which is to maintain a framework for ordered liberty so that Americans in their neighborhoods and over dinner tables can try to persuade each other how to worship and what to believe by arguments, not by fists and not by the police. Government doesn't get to do any of that in this country because we recognize that government is not God. Americans reject the divine right of kings, and we reject the infallibility of politics. Government doesn't try to make an example of your church or your synagogue or your mosque because some politician decided your views were out of favor. Your religious organization doesn't get taxed differently because a politician running for office decides to disagree with one of your beliefs. We believe, whatever faith you're from in America and whatever party you're in, we believe in America that all 225 million of us are created equal, and we believe that whether your faith is traditional or progressive, it is yours, and it's between you and your religious community and your God. It is not the domain of politicians. Government can't force you out of the public square because of the faith you hold. At least that's what we've always believed in the past. It's what we believed for more than 200 years. We're not perfect, of course. We've fallen short of that idealism time and time again. That doesn't mean the ideas of the American founding and the First Amendment are wrong. It means that our ideals need to be strived for yet again and reaffirmed. So I want to give every member of Congress the opportunity in the coming weeks to do just that. I don't care what some nitwit said on CNN last week to satisfy his fringy base and try to get a soundbite in a presidential debate. The American people ought to know that this body stands for the historic First Amendment. That's what we all took an oath to uphold and to defend, and that's what we ought to vote to affirm again. Let's do it. Thank you. I yield back.
And that from Senator Sasse is spot on. This is what we need to be talking about. Government is not the center of the universe. Government does not get to control what you believe or how you must worship or what you must say. As Senator Sasse rightfully pointed out in his remarks, the whole point of the First Amendment is that no matter who you love or how you do or don't worship, everyone is created with dignity. This is a fundamental American tenet and why this country was founded. We are all created with dignity, and no one has the right to dictate the conscience of other people. But we have to remain vigilant, and we have to be willing to stand up and speak out and protect our First Amendment freedoms. We're going to close the show today on, thankfully, a positive note from an otherwise tragic story that unfolded in court in Texas this past week. You might have seen the hashtag #ProtectJamesYounger trending on social media. This is the story in the case of a 7-year-old whose future is at stake because one parent is trying to forcibly transition this child, a boy, into a girl against the father's wishes. Jeff Younger has been battling his ex-wife in a Dallas family court over whether their child, James, a biological boy, has gender dysphoria. Last week, a jury ruled and granted sole custody of the child to the mother and was allowing for this forced gender transition to proceed. But on Thursday, a judge ruled that the divorced parents will have joint custody and that they will have to make joint medical decisions regarding their child, and they will have to jointly determine if James, a boy, should undergo hormone replacement therapy to transition to a girl through chemical castration. The child's father, Jeff Younger, has accused the boy's mother of forcing James to socially transition into a girl by making him wear dresses and telling him, quote, "Monsters only eat boys." This is a sad story, but thankfully the forced gender transition has been stopped and the father will not lose custody for treating his son like a boy. United States Senator Ted Cruz from Texas expressed outrage over the case, calling the forced gender transition of James, quote, "nothing short of child abuse," saying, "this is horrifying and tragic. For a parent to subject such a young child to life-altering hormone blockers to medically transition their sex is nothing less than child abuse. A 7-year-old child does not have the maturity to make profound decisions like this. The state of Texas should protect this child's right to choose as an informed, mature person and not be used as a pawn in a left-wing political agenda." Thankfully, there was a favorable ruling this past week, but we have to be ready for the next fight. Those on the other side who are in support of this are relentless in pushing and pursuing their agenda. And if you have questions or want more information, we have a great new resource available at our website, NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. It's called the Gender Resource Guide. It's the first of its kind. It's supported from organizations on the left and the right, as well as many medical professionals. It is chock full of scientific research, as well as personal testimony of parents and children who have been through this. It's phenomenal. It's very well done, and it can answer all of the most common questions and how to handle this difficult, divisive issue with grace and truth. And we hope you'll take advantage of it at NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. That's all the time we have for this week. I'm your host, Nate Graz, Policy Director for the Nebraska Family Alliance. Hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.